This is a Battle of Britain podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum.
Who won the Battle of Britain? Welcome to the Royal Air Force Museum podcast on Who Won the Battle of Britain. For this podcast, we will be assuming that you are familiar with the main phases of the campaign. If you are not, you may find it helpful to listen to our podcast Phases of the Battle of Britain first. By the end of June 1940, most of Europe had either been conquered or was controlled by Nazi Germany and her allies. Just in the last 6 weeks, Norway, Holland, Belgium, the Baltic states, France, and even the Channel Islands had fallen to invasion forces. Of those left, Ireland, Sweden, and Switzerland were strictly neutral. Finland had been defeated by the Soviet Union, and Spain, Romania, Greece, and Yugoslavia were all pro-German. Greece and Yugoslavia would eventually be attacked by Italy before the year was out. In short, only one country remained both unoccupied and willing to continue the fight to liberate Europe. This country was Britain. Although her armies had been pushed out of France and Norway, Britain retained an effective navy and air force and was prepared to defend herself to the best of her abilities. Hitler was determined that Britain, with her vast empire, was still a threat and should come under his control too. At the very least, he wanted a treaty making Britain subservient to Germany. If negotiations failed, Hitler appears to have been willing to invade Britain and ordered extensive preparations to begin under the codename Operation Sea Lion. The rest of the story usually runs as follows. Germany's air force, the Luftwaffe, was sent to subdue British defences and gain air superiority. However, they were seen off, albeit only just, by a plucky, outnumbered band of Royal Air Force fighter pilots. Therefore, by the end of September, Hitler had postponed his invasion plans, and the Luftwaffe had been forced to drastically modify their operations. Unable to survive in daylight over Britain, they had to switch to nighttime area bombing of London and other major cities, which became known as the Blitz. That's the simple version. The true story is much more complicated and open to heavy debate. Did Hitler ever really intend to invade, or was it a threat to bring Britain to the negotiating table? Had the RAF been defeated, would Sea Lion have been possible in an English channel defended by the Royal Navy? Did the RAF defeat the Luftwaffe, or in light of the Navy and Hitler's bluff, did they just simply give up? In short, who actually won the Battle of Britain, and what did they achieve? This is not an easy question to answer. One insurmountable problem stands in the way of clarity. We will be dealing with the inner machinations of the Nazi war machine. This was a chaotic organisation. Hitler, a fickle opportunist, was also highly opinionated and convinced of his own military genius. His unpredictable will was imposed on the armed forces to a crippling extent, and he even kept his armed services at each other's throats as a means of controlling them. Hermann Göring, commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, was also willful and opinionated. Although he had been a superb pilot during the First World War, his knowledge and ideas about air fighting would prove to be woefully outdated. Such personalities and policies of divide and rule meant that the actual intentions of Hitler and his forces are very hard, if not impossible, to divine. So really, the biggest question is, how serious were the Germans in wanting to invade Britain? This is unfortunately far from clear. On the 16th of July, Hitler issued Directive 16, ordering preparations for the invasion. Directive 17, the conduct of the air and sea war against England, followed soon after on the 1st of August 1940. In this, he laid out the process for the subjugation of Britain's defences, starting with the Royal Air Force. He wanted the Luftwaffe to launch an offensive as soon as possible, with a deadline of under 5 weeks to subdue the RAF, while also attacking naval, military and industrial targets. All the while, Hitler made overtures about a negotiated peace. The Luftwaffe had known that such an order was probably coming, but was still unprepared. They had taken 40% losses during the Battle of France and were now trying to rebuild their strength. The fact that they could now operate out of airfields in France did not help, as new infrastructure, communications and supply lines were needed. The Luftwaffe had been created to support field armies, not to conduct strategic operations. The job that they were about to attempt was not one that they were trained or equipped for. For example, their main fighter, the Messerschmitt Bf 109, only had enough fuel for around 20 minutes of combat time over England. Luftwaffe planning was in an even more dubious state. Goering, instead of formulating and laying out his plan, had asked each of his commanders to come up with their own plans. These differed vastly. Some commanders wanted to knock out the RAF by attacking their stations and installations first. Others wanted to launch attacks on the industrial and civilian targets, planning to force the RAF to come and fight them. This would allow their own fighters to destroy the RAF in the air, while also destroying the factories that could make new aeroplanes. In the end, Goering adopted a plan that was a little of each and nowhere near as effective as either, attacking targets based on their geographical location rather than strategic importance. Attacks would start in the coastal regions, and as the weeks progressed, would move further inland and towards London. It was a strategy doomed to fail, but Goering was not a man to be persuaded he was wrong. The plan was based on inexperience of these types of operations and, above all, poor intelligence. Target intelligence work was left to local, usually untrained staff, and so again there were mistakes and no real coordination. Many vital targets were never attacked, and much time was wasted on irrelevant targets. For example, less than half the airfields attacked during the battle were in use as fighter stations. The Germans did not understand how advanced the RAF's airspace command and control system was. It was largely based on radar, and they didn't realise fully how it worked, so were unable to strike its vulnerable points and knock it out completely. They also did not realise the full strength of the RAF, around 1,000 fighters at the start of the battle, with 1,250 pilots. By early October, despite casualties, the number of pilots had risen to over 1,700, while the factories were turning out twice as many new fighters as the Germans estimated. Of course, not all of these aircraft and pilots were with frontline squadrons, and they had to cover the whole country, not just the south coast where the Germans would concentrate most of their forces. The aerial offensive ordered by Hitler was to begin on Adlertag, or Eagle Day. Initially, this was set for the 5th of August, but bad weather saw it postponed several times until the 13th of August. In the meantime, attacks were carried out against convoys in the English Channel and against radar stations. These operations forced the RAF to put up standing patrols to waste time and effort and needlessly tire their crews and lose aircraft. The weeks after Adlertag saw massed but often misdirected and uncoordinated attacks against RAF stations, aircraft factories and radar sites across the south of England and occasionally in the north. Goering also kept changing his mind. Early on, he stopped the attacks on radar stations, which he erroneously believed to have been no use. From the 19th of August, he ordered his forces to concentrate on bombing aircraft factories, but just 4 days later, before his new policy had really had time to have an effect, he switched attention to RAF stations. On the 19th, he also ordered a change in tactics, forcing his fighter aircraft to give closer support to his bombers. In reality, this would just make his fighter force much less effective, despite the fact that they were actually achieving the goal of destroying RAF fighters. However, the attacks on stations began inevitably to wear the RAF down and hampered operations. The constant flying took its toll on the RAF pilots, with many suffering exhaustion and sleep deprivation. The RAF were within days of having to withdraw their squadrons further north, allowing the Germans air supremacy over the southeast. Yet just when his policy was really working, Goering changed his mind again. From the 7th of September, he began directing his efforts against London. This was partly in retribution for British raids on Berlin, themselves revenge for a small German force accidentally bombing London at night, and partly to force what he thought to be the last few British fighters up to fight and be destroyed. Thanks to poor intelligence, he predicted the strength of the RAF at around 150 to 300 fighters. In fact, there were four times this number available across the country. What Goering did do was give fighter command a vital break to repair their airfields and rebuild their strength. In doing this, he snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, for the Luftwaffe was suffering too. Although RAF claims were vastly exaggerated, the Germans were still losing aircraft at an unacceptable rate. German records show that between the 15th and 18th of August, the Luftwaffe lost 213 aircraft. In mid-July, the strength of the Luftwaffe units facing the RAF had stood at around 2,300 aircraft, about 1,000 of them fighters. By the end of August, nearly 900, over two-thirds of them fighters, had been lost. This amounted to over 1,300 aircrew. So it can be seen that the Luftwaffe efforts were far from ideal. They attempted to gain air superiority and did succeed in destroying some airfields and disrupting the command and control system which directed the RAF to the invading aircraft. But they never managed to overcome the RAF. In this, they lost the Battle of Britain by failing to formulate a strategy and maintain it. On the other hand, the Royal Air Force had expanded in preparation for war, and it presented an extremely effective opposition to the Luftwaffe. In addition to the fighters, there was the contribution of Bomber Command and Coastal Command, who attacked German shipping and invasion preparations incessantly, despite terrible losses. Fighter Command, meanwhile, sent fighters up daily to attack massed formations of German aircraft. They were supported by a highly advanced command and control system, able to direct the fighters straight onto enemy formations. On the ground, thousands of men and women did the vital work necessary to keep the pilots operational, not only in repairing or refueling and rearming the aircraft, but all the other things too. Try keeping your squadron flying without stores clerks to make sure you have the right spares and ammunition, or without cooks to keep the pilots functioning. Day after day, this well-oiled machine, despite heavy attacks, went into action and gradually inflicted unacceptable losses on the Luftwaffe, until in mid-September they decided that daylight raids were no longer maintainable and the night bombing of Britain's cities began. Ultimately, the strength of the RAF and its tactics had been misunderstood by the enemy. The Luftwaffe lacked a coherent strategy for the battle and tended to cherry-pick their tactics, the best example being the switch to bombing London. By the end of the Battle of Britain, the Luftwaffe was surprised by the quantity of operational RAF fighter aircraft, and ultimately the first victory over the Nazis had been won. So was the outcome of the battle due to the mistakes of the Luftwaffe or to the success of the RAF? There is a third argument that the battle for air superiority was incidental to the invasion plans. The German army and navy had already begun their massive preparations for invasion, with tens of thousands of barges and ships gathered and converted for military use at great expense. The army had trained and readied itself for an amphibious landing. They knew, however, that even with the RAF out of the way and air superiority ensured, they would still have to face the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy was theoretically more than capable of attacking and destroying any invasion fleet. It was a formidable weapon, and although it would most likely have taken heavy casualties, it would probably have severely disrupted any invasion effort. However, would the Germans, with air superiority, have been able to stop the Royal Navy? It's certainly a possibility. The Germans themselves had no operational battleships in the summer of 1940, but they did have several other methods of stopping the Navy, such as mines and U-boats. The most debated method, however, is the Luftwaffe. It has been claimed that the Germans did not have any aircraft or weapons that were truly effective against warships. Yet of the 60-odd Royal Navy warships sunk between the outbreak of war and mid-1941, nearly two-thirds were sunk by German aircraft. Equally, the German invasion fleet was also incredibly vulnerable to attack from the air. By ensuring air superiority, the Germans could protect their fleet from the aircraft of bomber and coastal commands. Indeed, during the battle, these two forces were launching continuous raids against the ports where the invasion fleet was being gathered. German estimates show that between 10 to 12% of the fleet had been destroyed by the RAF in this way, and in the end they were forced to withdraw many of their boats further east along the coast towards Germany, out of range of the RAF. These raids did cost the RAF, in particular Bomber Command, dearly, but without them it could be argued that the German invasion fleet would have been more successful. With just the Royal Navy to confront, the outcome could have been very different, particularly had the Luftwaffe been able to move to attacking the British fleets. It's easy to see why, in some eyes, the Luftwaffe became a scapegoat for the failure to successfully invade Britain. Of course, we cannot tell what was going to happen. The Nazis could have fought in Europe and not invaded Britain at all, and perhaps they'd have ultimately ended up fighting the United States in the West and Russia in the East. However, had they fought and overcome the British, the course of the war would surely have been more certain and dark for all of us. What we can say is that the Battle of Britain was launched by the German military with the aim of winning air superiority over Britain and the English Channel, as a prelude to totally subduing British resistance and their will to continue the war. This did not necessarily mean invasion. Sea Lion was certainly a prospect, the vast resources poured into it show it to be, but with air superiority there would have been other options. If the Royal Navy was that big a threat, then bombing could be used instead. If the Luftwaffe had been free to launch uncontested air raids against Britain's cities indefinitely, it may not have been too long before some sort of arrangement was made, even with the bulldog determination of Prime Minister Winston Churchill to resist. Without the victory, and a very visible victory, of the RAF happening as it did right over the capital, the will of the country may not have held. That was the Luftwaffe's aim. The RAF's was simple: to defend Britain from attack. And this is what happened. On the 17th of September, Hitler postponed his invasion plans. What had changed in those 6 to 8 weeks? The German army and navy were undefeated, and however half-heartedly, were still making their preparations. The Royal Navy was still sitting unused as a deterrent. Hitler was still the master of Europe, and Churchill was still making stirring speeches. The only thing that had changed was that the Luftwaffe had attempted to knock out the RAF and had failed. They had not achieved their stated objective. The RAF, on the other hand, had achieved theirs. They had defended Britain and fought their opponents to a standstill. This is often called a tactical victory, and under traditional military logic, it was. Britain had control of the battlefield, the skies over the UK, but the enemy was still in existence and still able to strike at Britain. They had been stopped, but they had not been destroyed. But let's take the wider view. The Battle of Britain was the first time that the Nazis had been unable to impose their will on Europe through military action. It was the first time it had been proven that Germany could be stopped, and as such it had lit a beacon. This beacon soon attracted the support of the United States of America in the short-term material and financial aid. In the long term, troops and arms also flowed in, and Britain was then ready to act as the springboard for liberating Western Europe from Nazi oppression. It was a long road and far from certain, but without the RAF's defence of Britain in the summer of 1940, no such springboard would have existed, and any such landings would have been severely doubtful. Therefore, the only logical conclusion can be that in the summer of 1940, the Royal Air Force in its entirety fought and won a significant tactical and strategic victory by ensuring that this country remained safe from invasion, and laying the first foundations for the eventual defeat of Nazism.
That was a podcast from the Royal Air Force Museum's Battle of Britain series. If you would like to learn more about the history of the Battle of Britain, why not visit the museum's Battle of Britain Hall in London, which houses the world's most comprehensive collection of aircraft that fought in the battle. The hall is open daily from 12 noon to 6 p.m.